Welcome to the February meeting of the UMass Union of Madison. And we're very honored to have Professor John Hawks as our Darwin Day speaker today. Darwin Day coming up on the 12th, is it?
Yeah.
He's going to talk to us about the 4.4 million year old human ancestor that's been discussed in the scientific circles of late. So thank you, John Hawks.
All right. Thank you. I'm weird because I do skeletal biology and genetics. I learned anthropology and biology from dealing with these fossils like this. And I still sort of think in that mindset. So I'm really excited about Ardipithecus. This is the skeleton that got unveiled last fall. This is it. This is what's there. Ardi is what they called her because of an absence of imagination. You have to understand that all of these fossils have nicknames. And they began with the Leakeys. And the Leakeys gave them such strange nicknames that there was one named Twiggy. There was another one named Nutcracker Man. They all gave them weird nicknames. So now, when people find something and they work on it for many years, this skeleton they were working on for 15 years to take it out of the ground, its consistency is really sort of chalky. So they had to put it into plaster jackets in the field and move it to the lab and excavate it from the surrounding very fine sediment very, very carefully. And so, you know, working on something for a long time, you start thinking about it like a person, and so they called it Ardi.
That's better than
A-R-D-I. It's better than Littlefoot, which is another one we're waiting to come out of the ground. Littlefoot's in Sterkfontein, South Africa, in a cave. In these caves in South Africa, I don't know if you guys have ever seen, you know, caves. They have this travertine that forms and stalagmites and stalactites. Well, if junk falls into a cave, dirt and bones and all kinds of stuff, well, then this calcite starts to form around it, and it makes a very, very hard matrix around the bones. And they have to excavate those with a light solution of acid to, you know, really itch away this calcite over time. Here they've got the opposite problem. It's ready to fall apart. And in order to save it, they have to stabilize it as they go. So they're stabilizing it with, ultimately, a plastic that they're able to put into the bone bit by bit to get it out of there. The end point of this is that after their very careful excavation, they have a skeleton, which is something like 75% complete. It's really an exceptional example.
That looks like a plastic kneecap.
That skull?
This is a little piece of plaster that's there stabilizing that bone. And you'll see a couple of examples like that around the hip joint there. There's a little piece of plaster. What's that?
I noticed the skull shape is so weird. That's not quite all the whole skull.
Well, what we've got here is the bones of the skull, and they're not put together. And I'm going to show you a scan that they did of the bones, reconstructing them. One of the things with this, you know, historically, when we find a skeleton in the field they're all fragmentary in some way. When we find a skeleton that's fragmentary, well, in 1880, the thing to do was to take the pieces of the skull and to mount them in beeswax, formed in the way that you thought the skull was. And you would use the anatomy of the skull to guide what it should be like. I studied some skulls like this last fall in Vienna, skulls from the Bronze Age, where they're mounted in wax. After that, the thing to do, maybe around 1910, was to cast the bones of the skull in plaster and then use them to construct a clay model of a plaster reconstruction and then cast that. So the university has casts of skulls that are from that era. This is better than we've had before. And I'll show you how it's better.
Is that a complete lower jaw?
It is a basically complete lower jaw. It lacks, your lower jaw has two parts that connect it to your skull. It's lacking those. And I believe it's only complete to about here. But that's really the important part from our standpoint, because it informs us about the jaw mechanics. The skull is less complete, but because of their technology, they've been able to mirror image it and construct an acceptable sort of reconstruction of what it would look like. The real important aspects of this, I'm going to show you. The skeleton is great to show a couple of things. First of all, notice that the tibia, that's shin bone, is a little shorter than the radius. Another thing is the length of these hands. Notice, this is the hand from here to here. If you put that the heel of that hand on this knee, you can see where it reaches to. I mean, if you put your hand there, you're not going to reach down to here. You know, this is a real, I like this. It shows the proportions really well. Proportions of this skeleton are long arms, short legs. Another thing, the opposable toes. I'll show you a couple of these things closer up. So here's a reconstruction of the skeleton. Sort of a life model of what the skeleton would have looked like. One of the things that you see in the news, if you hear about Ardipithecus, is about how it's a forerunner of humans. And you can see here the skeleton reconstructed as if it's a forerunner of humans. You've got basically an upright ape. And it's taking a step here up onto a branch. Well, it could have climbed into the tree. Look, it's taking a step onto a branch. I gotta tell you, that here's length of the leg, length of the arm. These proportions are the proportions of a quadruped. Bipeds do not have arms as long as their legs. What this does have is a couple of features that have really influenced these guys' reconstruction of this. One of the features is the base of the skull. I'll show you that a little later. The base of the skull, the spine, in an ape skull or a monkey's skull, the spine is going to contact the skull at an angle, and as a result, the hole in the base of the skull, which we call the foramen magnum, that's what your spinal cord comes through, that hole is posterior, it's toward back. In this skull, it's quite low. It's the bottom of the skull, and that indicates a more vertical spine. The other thing that's going on is the pelvis, and I'll spend some time on the pelvis in a minute. This pelvis is not human-like, but it's not ape-like either. And interpreting the locomotor pattern of this pelvis is sort of tough.
The tail seems very high.
Yeah, this little the tailbone, the sacrum tailbone. This is a very chimp-like reconstruction of it. They don't have this bone. They've reconstructed it in sort of a chimp-like way, and the reason why is because this is long. That's what's different between this and us, is that this is real long and this is real long. In us, these are short. Right, we'll talk about why that might be in a second.
What about the collarbone? It doesn't appear to be a collarbone.
Let's see here. There is not a collarbone. But if we look at this skeleton, where is the collarbone on the reconstruction? This is it right here. And the collarbone in an ape, you can see on this, it's reconstructed really long. Why is it reconstructed long? Collarbone on an ape is quite long and relatively stout. Apes, unlike monkeys, monkeys and apes go to the zoo, a monkey has a tail, an ape doesn't. But that's not the only difference. The main difference is that an ape has arms that are meant to do this. A monkey will not do this with its arms. You know, monkey arms are meant to do this. If it reaches up to grab into a branch, it's going to reach like this. An ape is just as likely to reach like this or to reach behind them or something. You know, their arms are like ours. They've got really mobile shoulder joints. Monkeys don't. Having a really mobile shoulder joint requires a really strong clavicle. In a monkey, the motion constrained like this, the clavicle and the scapula and the first rib, in many cases, work together to stabilize that joint. There's only so much you can do with the ligaments to connect those things into a real stable platform. With an ape, you've got to get more of it out of the shoulder joint, right, out of the clavicle. So, the reason why when kids are skateboarding and they fall and they hurt themselves is that clavicle there. The clavicle is doing its job. Its job is to stabilize the forces coming from the arm as they hit the trunk. In a monkey, stabilization mostly happens by springiness in the joints. With us, it happens like this. For toddlers, that's fine, but when you get to adult size, it doesn't work so well. Here's a fleshed out reconstruction. I like the reconstruction because it shows you what's going on. First of all, notice the breasts. Artie, the skeleton, we think is a woman, or a female, I shouldn't say woman, a female individual. I like to be reminded of that at this point because Artie is also quite large. 55 kilograms is the weight estimate we put on it. That compares to a chimpanzee female, which would be something like 35 kilograms. So Artie is big.
Can you tell it in pounds, please?
That would be for a chimp female, something like 75, 80 pounds. Mm-hmm. And for Artie, it'd be something like 120 pounds. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of this, those hands. They're different from chimp hands in one way. Artie's thumb is bigger. Now, when you look at that, you can see her thumb is not in a human proportion. That's true. But her thumb is bigger than a chimp proportion. Chimps have very, very small thumbs. Mm. Why do chimps have small thumbs? Chimps mostly are either suspensory or knuckle walkers. Mm. Knuckle walking is conditioned on them being suspensory. So if you're going to hang like this and support your weight and be anything like as large as a chimp is, or a gorilla, or an orangutan, then your fingers have to be quite powerful in this pose. It helps for them to be long, but certainly they have to be powerful. If they're powerful, what that means is that these tendons, which flex them, now those tendons, of course, are down here. You can feel them in your forearm when you move your fingers around. The tendons come here and all the way down to here through the carpal tunnel. The carpal tunnel is two bones that stick out in your wrist and the tendons go through them so that when your wrist is like this, you can still move your fingers around. And when your wrist is like this, you can still move it around. And the tendons are not here as they would be if there was just tension on them. They go around through this tunnel. Well, if you're going to have very, very long fingers and powerful flexion in those fingers, then your tendons are not going to be able to do this. In a monkey, they can do this. They put their hands right on the ground, their palmigrade on the ground. In an ape, can't do this very well. It would compromise their flexion to do that. So they keep their fingers like this when they're on the ground, which is the knuckle walking pose. This
walking around on the ground like this.
Well, for neither of those things do you need your thumb. You don't need your thumb for this. You don't need your thumb for this. Apes and other hanging primates, spider monkeys, for instance, who are monkeys, who have tails, prehensile tails, but also hang, they don't have thumbs. Apes all have their thumbs completely reduced down to very small size base of the wrist. They use them a little bit for manipulating, for tool use. Artie wasn't ape-like in this way, but neither was she especially human-like. We have big thumbs. Big thumbs, short fingers, useful for manipulating objects. I'm going to talk a lot about other early hominids, like Australopithecus. I'll show you some slides of Australopithecus, including Lucy, which is a famous one. Australopithecus had hands like ours. So this is a difference from hominids who lived after 4 million years ago. Okay, where are we? Humans, here, we share an ancestor with bonobos and chimps, the two species of chimpanzee, something like 4 million to 7 million years ago. I used to tell this as 6 million to 8 million, but I've changed it. The reason why I've changed it is that we've sequenced the human and chimp genomes, and the gorilla genome, and the orangutan genome. I mean, we've really got lots of genetics on these guys now. This date is, it could be young. It could be something like 4 million years ago. That means that Artie could be here if this date was old, something like 6 or 7 million years ago. Artie could be here if this date is young, like 4 or 5 million years ago. Or Artie could be over here, or over here on another branch, or Artie's somewhere around here. Now, the people who found Artie, naturally, would like her to be here. Because, frankly, you don't get your field permits renewed unless you I'm going to show you some other things that their discoverers would very much like to do. From my point of view, it's maybe even more interesting, but certainly as interesting, if it's here, or here, or here. Because what we really need to know about is, what's the diversity of primates at the time that humans, our lineage, is originating? Where do we come from? It doesn't matter if we found the one, or if we found something that's a maybe distant relative of the one. It's knowing that the African, in this case, northeastern African environment supports a certain kind of primate, and that it's possible to have this locomotor adaptation that no longer exists that really tells us what might have happened here. So it doesn't matter where it is. It's got to be somewhere like this. Could be over here. Why not? Artie as ancient gorilla? Could be. Can't be here, because all these guys lived in Asia.
What was going on 4 million years ago climatically?
5 million years ago was the end of the Miocene. And the Miocene at its end was accompanied by a couple of events. One of them was the Mediterranean Sea had completely dried up. It was closed at the Straits of Gibraltar, and it was dried up down to a very, very saline lake in the very bottom of it. Now, during that time, there were islands in the Mediterranean, Tuscany, Sardinia, were isolated from the European mainland for a while, and they became connected. There were apes that had been in Europe. There were large forests across southern Asia where the monsoon had started going something like 20 or 30 million years ago. These led to large forests across Asia. So there were apes across this whole range. The end of the Miocene, this had all declined. So that you had drying across northern Africa and the Mediterranean basin. You had drying across southern Asia and in East Africa. We can see that the environment had changed so that climax forest, we might say, had declined and grasslands had spread. It is not, at that time, as it is here, as it is now, where we have real plains across this. Now, these are sort of patchy forests. Also probably patchy forests here. This is a good time for primates, but a very bad time for apes. The apes had really gone into decline. Apes, what sets them apart? They're big, which means that they're slow. They're slow in reproduction. And it's that slowness of reproduction that seems to have led the apes to decline, and at the same time, monkeys sort of increase. Monkeys are fast reproducers compared to us. So, same environment, same habitat, different primates after the end of the Miocene.
Were they moving around with that water not there?
Up here? Yeah, there was some movement out here. And at 5 million years ago, almost precisely 5.2 million years ago, the straits open, and this whole thing fills with water. So that's a catastrophic event that really has a large effect on the climate in this whole area at 5 million years ago. Artie appeared in the Ethiopian highlands at a time when the Rift Valley was not as open as it is now, and at a time when, therefore, the rain shadow from the monsoon had not been established like it is now. It's living in what looks like, I'm going to keep saying the words patchy forest, but I think you have to understand what it's like. It's like the coastal forest of Brazil or the coastal forest of Africa now. It's a forest that depends on seasonality to a greater extent. There's a rainy season and a dry season. It's not like a rainforest where there's constant precipitation available, nor is it especially well watered. the water is a little bit, you know, you have to go a little ways to get water in these places. But it's not grassland. There's grass there. There's grass invading into the forest. But it's not like, you know, it's not like a savanna woodland like southeastern Wisconsin, where you walk around and there's a few trees, but mostly plains. Apes in the Miocene were not especially like apes now. This is Proconsul, an 18 million year old ape from Africa. And you can see Proconsul's arms and legs are the same length. That's the reason why I show you this. Apes in the Miocene were, a lot of the time, like monkeys now. Proconsul, in almost every respect, is like a baboon, except it's not a baboon, it's an ape. It's an ape that fits into a baboon-like niche.
It's got long thumbs.
It has long thumbs, as do monkeys. Here's what Proconsul looks like in the trees.
We spent a lot of time on the ground too.
Yeah, it's ideally sort of made for that terrestrial arboreal niche, where you're in the trees for defense, you're in the trees maybe for foraging for food, but you're also pretty effective on the ground. By contrast, here's a chimpanzee skeleton. Chimps have longer arms than legs. Their arms are longer. Chimps are mostly terrestrial. They spend most of their time on the ground. Gorillas even more so than chimps. We think of apes as swinging in the trees, and they do, but their predominant locomotor adaptation has to be really good at getting around on the ground too. So there's clearly a compromise between being terrestrial and being arboreal. The African apes meet that compromise in this way. It's knuckle walkers, longer arms than legs. Orangutans don't have the same compromise. Orangutans spend very little time on the ground. And they're not knuckle walkers. When they are on the ground, they walk on their fists and curl up their hands like this. This is Australopithecus. This is the first one to have been discovered. It's from South Africa, a site called Tong. And the reason why they knew it was a hominid, this one in particular, the guy who described it, Raymond Dart, was basically a doctor. He taught anatomy at the University of Witwatersrand. And Dart was interested in paleontology. A lot of people were. South Africa has a lot of really good paleontology. And at this time, 1924, not a lot of good paleontologists. So it was a real chance to discover cool things. And so Dart was going around to these lime mines where they were blasting out for lime. And limestone has caves in it lots of times. And if you're looking for lime, the cave is what you don't want because it's full of garbage for you. And so they blasted it out. And he would pay kids to sort of look around the blast site after a dynamite had gone off and see if they find anything interesting. And one day they found a jaw, this one. And he's really excited about it because it's clearly a primate, but it's got these little tiny canine teeth. And this is a kid. This turns out to be the skeleton of a four-year-old. So the fact that it has little tiny canine teeth here is maybe not so important, but it also has little tiny canine buds inside of it. And it's clear that the first molar is erupted at an accelerated pace compared to these other teeth. So Dart said, this is sort of human-ish. Well, so he's at somebody's wedding, and the kids come up with a box from the same place, and he's like, oh, forget this wedding. I mean, he goes in his morning coat, right? And he's digging through the box, and he finds the skull with this brain case, this endocast of the inside of the skull. This becomes the first Australopithecine. It was the earliest hominid known at that time. It's famous in anthropology because it was completely what the British anthropology establishment thought should never exist. Right? Here it is, it's got human-like teeth and a small brain. The Brits all thought that it should have ape-like teeth and a big brain. The reason is that they had their own British fossil that proved that the British Isles were the origin of humankind. It was called Piltdown. So this was, out of the line of ancestry. It must be. It must be some sort of aberrant ape. And so people argue about this for a long time.
What's the age?
We now know that this is about 2.9 million years old. Then they had no idea. They thought it was the oldest yet known, but they had no radiometric dating. So they knew it was Pliocene. That makes it, in their point of view, something like 400,000 years ago. Well, here's Australopithecus. But we have a lot of these, and it's worth talking for a minute about what we know about them. First, Australopithecus lives in Africa. We've never found Australopithecus anywhere else. We have found it in South Africa, in East Africa, in North Central Africa. It gets around, but it never shows up anywhere else. We don't know why this is. It could be that there's no corridor of suitable habitat that they could get from here to there, although some species did. It could be that they did make it here somewhere and we haven't found them yet. Some of us think that. Not necessarily me, but some anthropologists think that. It could be that there's something funny about them that we don't really understand in terms of their habitat limitations. It seems, from the places that we find them, that the earliest Australopithecines all lived in the woods. Many people have heard of the whole savanna theory, that humans started walking upright because we descended from the trees and started walking in the plains. It didn't happen. These hominids were walking upright, were, as you'll see, adapted to upright locomotion like us. They lived in the woods. We've never found them anywhere that didn't have significant wooded tree coverage. After 2 million years ago, maybe 2.5 million years, we start to find them once in a while in grasslands. So the earliest evolution of humans was something that happened in forest. This might be the earliest of our ancestors, Sahelanthropus. This is from Chad, North Central Africa. I say might because I raised this issue of how long ago did we diverge from chimpanzees. This fossil is 7 million years old. If this was the earliest hominid, then it would imply that the divergence between us and chimps was really very early. What is it about this that looks like a hominid? This fossil in particular has the base of the skull, the foramen magnum, that hole, is forward. It looks like a vertically carried spine. We know nothing else about it. However, there's one other thing. The canine teeth, here it is right here, are a little bit small-ish. Small-ish is a relative term. Chimpanzees have big canine teeth. Gorillas have big canine teeth. Most apes do. Female apes sometimes don't. This is not a likely female skull. It's got this big brow ridge on it, for one thing. It looks like a male. But its teeth, its fangs, its canine teeth, not super unusual for a female ape, maybe. Here's another set of bones. These are 6 million years old. These are from Kenya. Sahelanthropus was from Chad. These are from Kenya. They've got a leg bone. If you scan this leg bone and look at the internal structure of this part of the femur, this neck, the internal structure looks like a human. The internal structure reflects the distribution of weight through the hip joint. If you're walking upright, then you're preferentially directing weight up and down on this bone all the time, and so you have an internal structure that reflects that. If you're a quadruped, or climbing a lot, you're loading this bone in lots of different positions, and as a consequence, you end up with a more even distribution of bone, like chimpanzees. This is human-like. It could be the earliest of our ancestors. It could be a biped. It also, I should point out, also has smallish, here's a canine tooth, also has smallish canine teeth. Ardipithecus, up until now, was best represented by this set of bones, and how do we know that it is a hominid? One reason is it has small-ish canine teeth. I keep showing you these and pointing at them and saying they're small. I understand. I don't have a comparison that shows them next to a chimp, but I do have one in a minute, I think, that does. How do we know it's a hominid? This is a toe bone. This is the proximal, that's nearest to your foot bone, of the second toe. So your pointer toe, if you like. And on this, on the proximal end of it, the part that attaches to your foot, it's got this little divot. That little divot would only be there if they did this. Walked on tippy toes. Now, of course, we do this because every time we take a step, we flex our toes upwards. This is a dorsiflexion, we call it. We do this. Most primates don't. So, I was embarrassed up until last year. I talked to my classes about the great evidence for early hominids, and what I've got is their teeth like this and one toe. It's terrible. It was just awful.
How do the non-human foot's feet work then? If they're not doing that,
basically they can do this sort of thing more than we can. So they've got grasping feet, and the grasping toes can cant off to the side when they're walking, whereas ours always go with a toe off. You know, at some point. In some sense, if you're palmigrade on your feet, you're free to have that a little bit more range of motion. But at some point, you're not, because those feet still have to grasp onto stuff. We've abandoned the grasp. You know, we have these short little toes that are no good for grasping onto anything. And so we've committed ourselves to having that dorsiflexion of our feet. It's good for walking, but it's bad for grasping. Okay, here's canines next to each other. What do I got here? Chimp. Male chimp. Excuse me. Male chimp. Female chimp, I believe. It's female chimp.
These are all canines.
Yeah, these are canine teeth.
Canines.
Male chimp, female chimp, Ardipithecus, 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 Australopithecus. So we've got a range of canine sizes, but all of them are small-ish, sort of female chimp range at most. Okay, let's talk about the foot. This, to me, is the most exciting part of the skeleton because it's the easiest to interpret. This foot grasped onto things. That's something that human feet don't. It's something that Australopithecus feet did not. This is clearly a grasping foot. I've got a student, a graduate student, who studies, his dad's a podiatrist, so he loves feet. For the dad, feet equals money, right? For my student, he's just interested in the foot anatomy. And the cool thing about this is that the way that these bones are formed, it's almost as if this foot is made to have sort of a tripod.
Yeah.
On the heel, the first toe, and the other feet. So that instead of our foot, which has the arches to support our weight and collect energy from them and spring outward, this foot's made like a tripod. It's a different sort of way of supporting weight on the feet than we use, and it's different than other primates use. That's kind of cool. It suggests that our origin may have been much more like this than like a chimpanzee-like morphology, which is very flat-footed. But it's not like we magically, you know, got suddenly one new arch-like foot anatomy. Okay, Australopithecus, here's some footprints. Australopithecus had feet like ours. At most, you see a couple of these tracks. At most, their big toe diverges just a little bit, but you can see it's up there, it's long, it's with the other toes. There's an arch. Australopithecus at 3.6 million years ago had feet that would not be unusual if they walked into the kindergarten. Maybe a little long-toed. You know, you'd think, that kid's a little strange. But not outside, no, not so strange for humans. Okay, body size. Here I've scaled them, the body size. Australopithecus was small. Female, female, female. And you guys know the range of variation in female body size in humans. The average height of women in the U.S. is 5'4" nowadays. This skeleton I chose to be about that height. Lucy, the most complete skeleton of Australopithecus until next year. Lucy is about 3'4" or 5", just over a meter tall. So here's me. Here's Lucy. Artie was pretty big. Artie was bigger than a male Australopithecus. This is a big species we're talking about.
We figure that's an adult.
Definitely an adult. We know adult. We know age from things like the completion of the bones. You know, as the bones grow, they fuse, and so we know that it's an adult. Also the teeth. This also teeth. Yeah, these are all adults. Arm bones. This is a fun comparison. This is Lucy's radius and Artie's radius.
Wow.
I mean, Lucy's proportions are not human-like. She has relatively long arms compared to a human of her size. But they are not consistent at all with quadrupedalism. Her arms are too short. You and I look comical if we try to walk on the ground with our arms. I mean, it just doesn't work because our arms are too short. Lucy's arms were too short. Artie's arms are long enough. But these other things reflect body size, too. Okay. A broad comparison of a chimp and Australopithecus shows that Australopithecus is very much like a chimp in terms of its skull. Its brain is not very much bigger. Its teeth, it turns out, are bigger than a chimp's teeth, except for the canines, which are smaller. But you can look at that face and say, that's an ape's face. This pelvis is a human's pelvis. So what Australopithecus does is combine a chimp-like skull and a human-like pelvis. That's the rule up until about 2 million years ago, when we finally get some more human-like skulls into the fossil record. Well, Artie. So human pelvis at the top, Australopithecus pelvis at the bottom, and I'm showing you this one to remind myself to say, they're not identical to us in the pelvis. One of the things that's different about Australopithecus is that its pelvis is very broad, but short from front to back. And that reflects a difference in proportion. Notice, this is a human female. This is Lucy's. Lucy's pelvis is wider than this human female's, despite the fact that Lucy is 3 feet tall. So it is a different proportion that these early hominids have. It's of some interest to us why that should be. One thing is that the birth canal here is quite large relative to its body size. Maybe it's about birth dynamics that they have this broad pelvis. This is one hypothesis. Maybe it's about muscle dynamics. One reason why our pelvis has these big, broad, flaring hip blades is, if you notice, you step on one foot, you can feel your muscle here. It's that muscle that keeps your body upright every time you take a step. And the wider that is, the better leverage that muscle has. So having a broad pelvis is useful for being a biped in a way that it's not for quadruped. All right, I'm going to flip forward here too. This is Artie's pelvis. I don't have these on one slide, so I'm going to quickly. Here's Lucy. Here's a chimp. The difference here is that the chimp's pelvis is much longer here, and very stabilized right here. These are attached by ligaments that are very strong, so that an ape's back is very stiffly attached to its pelvis. If an ape bends over, its pelvis bends over. If you bend over, it's your spine that bends. Now, why does an ape have a long pelvis? It's because if you're going to have your legs like this and have power in them, then the power develops from the hamstring muscles, which are attaching here, and the quadriceps, which are attaching in front of this. Making them powerful means making these lever arms longer. In a human, it's useless to have those be long. Your hamstring, when you're walking, is completely flabby. It does nothing at all.
Speak for yourself.
No, everybody's hamstrings are flabby when we're walking. The only time you ever see people with built hamstrings is sprinters who start like this. Because it's that motion that gets your hamstrings in use. This motion does nothing for them. We use our gluteus maximus muscle. If we're climbing, if we're walking just a little bit to go uphill, for instance, we've changed the muscle that we use for this. The chimp is using a very basic quadruped mammal-like anatomy. We're using something else. Hardy, weirdly enough, is sort of in between. It has... This is a CT reconstruction of what it ought to look like. We just showed you the bone a second. It's crud. Yucky. It's tall. It's long. The quadriceps and hamstrings should have been effective for a quadruped. What it has that a chimp doesn't is a very mobile back. It's not real obvious why it should be that way. This is sort of a cool one, because what they've done is they've superimposed Lucy's pelvis, which is yellow, directly onto Artie's pelvis, which is gray. And you can see the difference is real direct. The hamstrings here are more effective. Long lever arm here. That's good for being quiet. The iliac blades are shortish, especially compared to chimps, and not hugely attached to the sacrum. Mobile back in a quadruped. It's not especially obvious what is going on with that. Canines, I meant to point out again. Canine teeth. People have looked at the canines in hominids. We all have small canines, we hominids. And it's a question why, when all the other apes have these big canines. What are apes... Yeah, what are apes using this for?
Tearing.
You'd think, well, this is functional, right? They're using it to, you know, tear into meat. Except that gorillas don't eat meat.
Ferocity.
Scaring away your enemies.
These are social tools for these primates. Canine means I'm going to hurt you. And if you are displaying your canines, you know, if you see a chimp smiling at you, that is, I'm going to hurt you. It's not. It might be, stay away from me. I'm going to get desperate in a minute. It is not. That a funny joke you just told. No, it's not like us. I mean, humans, we show our teeth. This is not, I'm going to eat you now. You know, this is something very pleasant. It's nice. I'd like to see the smile. It's very social. And so most of us, when we look at the canines, are interpreting their reduction in social terms. Why do you have small canines? Because you communicate in a different way. This could be true. I don't know. We don't have any better theory for this.
Eat less meat.
What's that?
Eat less meat.
Well, we eat more meat than chimps do.
Do we?
Yeah, if we want to measure on diet, we have a much more carnivorous diet than a chimp. We have more
hands for knives and forks.
That is true. We're using our hands. But Australopithecus had these little teeth, little canine teeth, before there were any stone tools. So there's something about this that's specifically hominin-like. It's like our branch of the tree. It's not human-like. It's not real obvious what it is. If you watch the television program about, here's Ardipithecus the dentition. If you watch the television program about this, they're going to tell you about how this means that they were, you know, men and women were sharing the load, and they were all, you know, friendly toward each other, and groups were organized and cooperating. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's not predictive. If we look at mammals who have small canine teeth, we don't predict social dynamics on that basis. It could be that social dynamics change and the canine changes as a result. But it's really hard for us to predict that would be true in one species. So I say it's a hypothesis. Could be true.
I don't want to go into crazy detail about teeth. I will say, from the perspective of diet, all right, here's Artie's dentition, the rest of the teeth, and Australopithecus. What you'll notice is that here the canines are not super different. This canine is pulled out of the socket of it. This one's in the right place. This canine's a little smaller than that one, but not a lot. But these teeth are all smaller. Look at that compared to that. Australopithecus had big, thick, grinding teeth. Their teeth were made to put hard things in and grind them up. We don't know, entirely what the hard things were. Might have been seeds. Might have been underground roots. You know, maybe they dug in the ground and got these fibrous roots out. But these are not high-crowned, scissor-like teeth like gorillas have. They're really made for cutting up fibers and vegetation. These are made for this. Artie's are not. Artie's are chippish in this respect. Artie was not eating what Australopithecus was. Probably that means it was relying on fruit. More so than Australopithecus. Australopithecus was probably relying on other terrestrial available.
Were they making tools at this point yet?
No tools until 2.6 million years ago. So tools are after all of these guys. Okay. There's the hands. I talked about them already. Was Artie a knuckle walker? We can answer that question. No. But it didn't have Australopithecus-like hand proportions. Here's some hands from Australopithecus, and they're very much like, here's a proximal thumb bone and the thumb metacarpal. So you're getting a representation of the thumb. It's long. And the fingers are short. From the standpoint of stone tools, I'll say those fingertips are sort of smallish. A human hand have much bigger fingertips. And that's because we can apply a lot more force this way through them. So when we're making a stone tool or we're using tools, we're applying force here to keep it from slipping our grasp, basically. Australopithecus didn't do that. And that's consistent with the fact we haven't found any stone tools. It doesn't mean they weren't using some kind of tools. They were not doing this sort of thing that we have done of late. Now, I do want to say one really important aspect of this discovery is the extent to which they were able to reconstruct the paleo environment of this creature. At Aramis, the site where they found this in Ethiopia, their field site extends across a very large area. It's like the size of Connecticut, these guys have. And in this locality, what they had was two volcanic layers that here are very prominent, you can see them, and about 3 or 4 meters in between them. I think it's about 11 feet in between these. And you can see that everything that's in here has to be localized at one time. So when you have this place, and you can look across a large area, they have 11 kilometers of exposure where they can sample this particular time interval across a long strip of ancient environments. And they were able to show that on one end of this, you've got dry-ish environment represented by species that today live on dry grasslands. So you've got things like impala and lions, dry grassland-like things. And on the other end, you've got wooded, a little bit swampy environment. There's monkeys. There's a couple of hippos. There's the antelopes are bush bucks. So you've got very clear indicators. They also have indicators from pollen of what the environment was. The cool thing about this is across these exposures, Ardipithecus is always in the places with the woods, never in the places with the grass. So it's a really clear example of one slice of time, which they figure lasted about 1,000 years of accumulating this between these two tephra. And they're able to show the clear habitat association. That's something that has never been done before in the human fossil record. So it's really cool.
Do they have any hypotheses on why that was the habitat rather than grasslands?
They're figuring that the apes are living in the trees. This is a
so
very...
They're living in trees.
This is a forest-dependent ecology.
That.
So why did bipedalism start with that? If there's no savanna intrusion, what caused the shift to...
Now this is a terrible question. Well, first of all, remember, Ardipithecus is not necessarily a biped. It's got some features. And you say, what is the animal like that has these apparent adaptations to vertical posture and maybe more terrestriality, reflected by the feet, but... It's an ape. What is it doing? One hypothesis about this is vertical feeding postures. So what you're doing is reaching up for stuff. And that's possible. Another hypothesis about this is that it has to do with predator avoidance. You're standing up to look around. It can be alert. So a little bit more openness might lead you to have different predation influencing you. I have to say, Artie, we haven't worked this out. So, say, the classical explanations are this. Artie doesn't fit that very well. Artie's too big to have a lot of predator problems. Chimpanzees do not have a lot of predator avoidance behaviors, because chimpanzees don't have to worry about anybody bigger than a leopard, smaller than a leopard. And there aren't that many leopards. So, I don't know. Well, this is about the end. Here's some more paleo. Here's what it would have looked like, maybe. This is where bushbucks live. Bushbucks, swampy, yeah. Oh, I'll show you the skull. I'll just stop on this, because in some sense it gives you the picture of what it would look like, but I don't want to... Okay. Artie. Yeah, this is probably the best one. This is so cool, because they were able to scan the bones, and use computer methods to reconstruct, which... For these bones, which are very fragile, is important. I mean, the less people who lay hands on these, the better. And you can work with the computer model, and you can test hypotheses about it. So one aspect of this is this question about the position of this foramen magnum. They're able to align these bones, the temporal bones, which are not connected with each other, but they're able to align them accurately because they can scan the insides and see the semicircular canals. And the semicircular canals are in very stereotypical positions because that's where your postural information comes from. Mm-hmm. So you know that they're aligned with horizontal and vertical planes. So you can align the bones that way. This is awesome stuff.
Computer comes in very handy, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very necessary in this case. Okay. That's pretty much what I have to say about it. I don't have any overarching conclusion.
Are there three cams available that someone with the equipment can run on a 3D printer and actually produce replicas or not?
In principle, yes. The problem here is availability. In practice, the researchers who generate, this is their field site, these guys don't share the data. So. In practice, no, but in principle, yes.
Okay. Are there from any of the skeletal remains?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a number of things that CT scans are available and with a 3D printer, you can print it out. Uh-huh. And it's even gotten to the point where, now these scans, up until a couple of years ago, were mostly medical resolution scans, yeah, which for our purposes are not great.
No.
You know, they're good for looking at the internal structures of things. But even for things like the semicircular canals, a medical resolution scan is not going to give you what you want. Lately, the medical resolution scanners have gotten better. It's not every hospital that'll let you walk in the door and scan something. Let me tell you, if you're going to take one of their CT scanners and put a rock in it, it's going to mess something up. Just on the basis of the reflectance is so different, you've got to change the machine, and then you've got to recalibrate. It's very difficult. But lately, they've been using, and for these bones, which are fragmentary, you put them into a micron-level scanner. And so you can have, they have micron-level scanners that are about this big that were developed for rats. Because if you're doing biological research on a small rat model, and you want to see trace the presence of chemicals and so on in the body, it doesn't matter how, you don't want to put it in a giant medical size thing, you just stick it in a tube, put it in the scanner, and you can scan micron level things. You can do that with these things if they're broken.
Yeah, if I could leap and land 2 years ahead, what do you think is the reason for the explosive growth of the human brain?
There are three hypotheses that make sense, and overarching hypotheses, right? Hypothesis one is climate instability increased at the end of the Pliocene, and as a result, you had to be smarter to live through an unstable climate if you're going to have a long life history like humans do. Obvious problem with that hypothesis, every other species was suffering from this unstable climate, and we're the only ones who had this increase in brain size. Okay. Hypothesis two is sociality. We're competing with each other. And on that basis, especially after we become technological beings, we're living in groups, we're cooperating, we're competing with other groups of humans, and so there's group selection for intelligence, and brain size comes along with it. The smarter groups are the ones that win out. That has a great bonus, that it predicts a runaway sort of effect. You know, if your main competition is other people, then you always have to be, it's like, you know, your main competition is other NFL teams, you always have to have the biggest lineman. Mm-hmm. And so, as a result, linemen increase in size through the 20th century. The brains are the same way, in principle. Problem is that other kinds of animals are also competing against each other in groups, and I'll point out that there are advantages to being small brain too. Within a group, if you can sort of leech along with the other, you know, with the smart ones, then you can get the same resources and win the same competitions with saving energy in your brain, and it might be good to be small some of the time. So there's a balance there. It's not obvious how it works out. Hypothesis three is that we're smarter for technology. Now, advantage of that hypothesis is that this brain acceleration really starts after stone tools emerge in the fossil record. So it makes sense in time-wise. Problem with the hypothesis is that there are long periods of stasis in the archaeological record. People make the same tools all the time, but the brains grow. Mm-hmm. So those are the three really overarching models: climate, technology, social competition.
Isn't cooking one of the hypotheses?
So cooking.
Cooked food so that they can eat.
Cooking is a hypothesis. Now, why didn't I list? Cooking has a problem as a hypothesis, in that the reason why cooking has an effect on your brain, in theory, is that it makes energy more available. Okay. Easier energy availability means you can devote more energy to brains. Problem with this scenario. If you make energy more available to any other species in nature, well, you know what the outcome is going to be.
Obesity.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, let's take deer. There's plenty of deer around here, right? You know, the deer like sugar beets. So if you take a bunch of sugar beets, a truckload of sugar beets, and dump it on your land every week, the outcome will be?
More deer.
Lots more deer, yeah. Food availability means more population.
But you're specifying sweets.
Make it carrots. The outcome is the same, right? In other words, the fastest response to increased energy availability is population. When population increases, the pressure for energy reestablishes itself. So you've got to have a reason not only why energy becomes more available, but also why bigger brains are advantageous in that context. The cooking hypothesis makes the energy more available, but it doesn't explain why brains are better. Yeah, why bigger brains succeed. Yeah.
Now, I know brain size has gotten a lot of press for years and years and years and years, but I thought the latest thinking was that brain size is not really the ultimate thing to look at.
Well, brain size is bad. There's no question that if you could choose between being smart and having a big brain, or being smart and having a small brain, small brains are better. Small brains develop faster, they take less energy, and they take less protein to develop.
And there are other things. They create less of a constraint at birth through the birth canal and that sort of thing.
Yeah. What about the wrinkles and stuff on the brain? Does that change from large to small?
There is a relationship. Bigger brains tend to be more wrinkled. The relationship emerges because the cortical area, the area of the surface, is where the neurons are. And so neuron bodies increase at a faster rate than volume increases. It's not obvious that you sort of had a choice of being more wrinkled or being bigger. We have bigger brains. They are more wrinkled. Those may have just come together as a process of allometric growth. So big brains are bad. Yeah, we have bigger brains. What that implies is that the functions of the brains that were targets of selection, that were good, were strong enough in their effect on us that they outweighed some of the disadvantages of having big brains. But what that means is that we always have to keep in the backs of our big brains that this is not the goal of evolution, to have big brains. And that brain size represents a compromise between two opposing forces. And it's clear that the balance between those forces changed in human evolution. But you can see that the ledger book on either side of those forces, on the side of bigger brains are bad, that ledger is filled by hard to get energy, hard to develop, takes a long time, and needs lots of protein. And the ledger book in favor of bigger brains is smarter. Smarter. Smart, good. Maybe something
but I guess
else.
That was my point. I thought that there was recent evidence to show that, yeah, in general, bigger brains mean smarter, but it's not as strong of a correlation as was thought in the past.
You know, what's mysterious is that it's not zero.
Yeah.
To give a quick example, basketball. You need to ask.
They have small brains.
Who is are taller basketball players better? Are taller players better basketball players?
Maybe.
It clearly depends on the level you're talking about, right? If you're a coach of a high school team, taller players are better.
Uh-huh.
If you're a coach of an NBA team, taller players might be worse. You know, it's because at that level, they've been selected for basketball playing. They haven't been selected for height. Mm-hmm. Height comes along with it. So what you've done is, in this process of getting the NBA, you've selected out all of the variance, the covariance, between height and ability. So that at the end, you've got a very high ability set of players who are, on average, a whole lot taller than the rest of us. But within that set, the relationship between height and ability is pretty much nil. Good short NBA players, good tall NBA players, even though none of them are 5'3", right? But brains are the same way. Yeah. So if we've been selected for good brains for 2 million years, you would think that any covariance between smartness and brain size should be nil. We should be like the NBA of brains. And yet we're not. We have covariance between brain size and what we measure as intelligence. And so one, I think maybe along your lines, interpretation of that is that the thing that you're measuring, IQ, let's say, is not what was the target of selection. It's in some sense orthogonal to the target of selection. Which means that what made brains worth it, what made brains good in an evolutionary sense, is something that is not exactly what we think of when we're thinking of intelligence. Something maybe more practical.
Yeah.
I've always had the impression that during these eras that these isolated bands of humanoids or wherever they are through Europe and Africa, well, that seemed to me that would be isolated gene pools and you'd get genetic, bad genetics in things like that. How did that ever work out?
Well, one scenario for how it worked out is all the bad ones are gone. It's a serious scenario, right? There were people spread across the earth 2 million years and after ago, and most of those people went extinct. We're the descendants of a few of them. It's not obvious
how that interaction went. I mean, of course, here we're talking much later than this, but it's in some sense the same question. Are interactions that lead to evolution within a species, do they tend to be focused in one or two places that drive the changes in the rest of the range? Or do they tend to occur over large space? And we can test that scenario. We can look at the pattern of change. For brain size, the pattern of change is very much the same, whether we're looking at Neanderthals in Europe, or Homo erectus in Asia, or Homo erectus in Africa. All of these guys get bigger brains. So it looks like the pattern is consistent with one process. And nevertheless, something like 50,000 years ago, it was a big shift, and Neanderthals are gone, and Homo erectus is gone, and our ancestors, something like modern humans, is left. So in the human case, it looks like elements of both are happening. Sometimes the process is the same in large areas of the world, and at other times, it's one area that seems to drive what's happening.
Okay. Bill had a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if maybe the fact that we only use 10% of our brain has something to do with, you know, maybe the other 90% is what's driving the growth in brain size, and for what function we don't know.
Well, it's exactly right in the sense that we don't know what the function was that was important. It's probably a combination of lots of things. I mean, our brains don't just do one thing. The part that we're aware of being relevant now may not be the part that was important in the past.
So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.